Patricia Camilleri, Director of the Communications and Alumni Relations Office here at the University of Malta. In this series called Research Matters, I shall be discussing the many research projects undertaken by the university's academics from all fields of study.
It is a delight, and most certainly a privilege, to have with me in the studio today on Research Matters the much acclaimed novelist and short story writer Anne Enright, whose already successful writing career was sent into the stratosphere when she was awarded the Man Booker Prize for Fiction in 2007 for her novel The Gathering. A very warm welcome to the programme, Miss Enright.
Thank you. That's lovely to be here.
At this point, I usually say a few words about my guests. Anne Enright was born in Dublin, studied English and philosophy at Trinity College, Dublin, and went on to study for an MA in creative writing at the University of East Anglia. She's also a former RTE television producer. Her short stories have appeared in prestigious magazines, including The New Yorker and The Paris Review. And she won the 2004 Davy Burns Irish Writing Award for her short story, Honey. Her short story collection, The Portable Virgin, was published in 1991 and won the Rooney Prize for Irish Literature. And a collection of stories, Taking Pictures, has now been put together in a publication entitled Yesterday's Weather, which was published in 2008. Her novels are The Wig My Father Wore, shortlisted for the Irish Times Aer Lingus Irish Literature Prize, What Are You Like, which was winner of the 2001 Encore Prize and shortlisted for the 2000 Whitbread Novel Award, The Pleasures of Eliza Lynch, and of course, The Gathering, which is about a large Irish family gathering for the funeral of a wayward brother. Anne Enright has also published a book of humorous essays called Making Babies, Stumbling into Motherhood. She lives in Ireland. I'm always a little bit embarrassed when I give these necessarily brief introductions to my guests, guests such as yourself, because it seems such a limiting thing to list publications when there's so much behind them. I hope that in the few moments we have together today, we'll have a chance to expand a little on what really makes you the writer you are. Do you have a little canon of literature of your own when it comes to influences, or are your literary influences literary or personal or both?
Well, I suppose you write from your life and you write from where you are in your life. So much of my work is personal to a degree. It's always fiction, mind you. I'm usually making it up, which sometimes is hard to explain. I want to say, no, I just made that up. When it comes to literary influences, it's very interesting to see how they shift over the decades. You know, that the writers who made me passionate and happy when I was 16 or 17 are different to the ones that engage me now. There are certainly writers who I hooked on to quite early without even realising that they were pulling me along. You look at someone like Flannery O'Connor, the wonderful Southern Gothic American short story writer and novelist. And she probably, I would say now, is an influence. But some of the influences are so ancient you can't even remember what they are. You know, you grow up in Ireland and, the poetry of Yeats is so much in the texture of things and the way people write. And so I would have been reading his poetry since, you know, the age of 12 or something. And yet I'd never say he's an influence, but he's absolutely there in the air and in the fabric of things for me and the way language is constructed. When I went to the University of East Anglia, I went there very specifically to work with a writer called Angela Carter, a British writer who wrote immensely lush and slightly disgraceful books, very intelligent, very funny. She died, unfortunately, some years ago. And she would have been a great influence on my early work. Not that she was my tutor, that she said anything in particular about my work. She just said, oh, this is all fine. And but it was wonderful to be greeted as a writer by her.
Did you have a sort of family tradition of interest in writing, or were you the first one to come up with this bright idea?
No, there were always books in the house. My grandmother was a great reader. My mother was a great reader. My father's very interested in words and dictionaries and crosswords and jokes, more than in fiction. So there were always books in the house. Books in that strand of Irish life were extremely important, both as a kind of way of defining yourself as Irish, because the country was founded by poets and playwrights, but also that books gave this very interesting space when Ireland was at its most conservative, its most censoring. There was this freedom within books, which meant that the content was often quite alarming, actually. But nobody seemed to mention this. there was an amnesty there. And I think a necessary kind of escape valve or steam valve for the society, that the writers were considered important and mostly unassailable, although people had very hard times in the 60s in Ireland. Writers were banned, books were burnt, but there was still they were still iconised in a funny way.
I can't say, of course, that I'm in any way an expert on your writing. However, it's clear from what I have read and looked at, and from what others have written about you, that your approach to writing is sharp and perhaps even sometimes raw, very raw. One reviewer refers to it as the sheer physicality of Enright's writing, while somebody else refers to it as writing that is horribly skillful. You obviously have quite an unforgiving descriptive mode. If you indeed agree with that comment, what makes you choose that way of writing?
Yeah, well, just, I'm not a satirical writer. I don't laugh at my characters. I don't have contempt for them. So if I am unforgiving, it's not for the flaws and foibles of my characters, but more about perhaps the human condition. Now, I refuse to say, for example, that we don't die, you know, which is one of the things. So, yes, there's a concern with mortality in the work, and there's certainly a concern with the body and physicality, very strongly so. Sometimes I kind of think people want me to be a nicer writer, a more forgiving writer, or a warmer writer, because they want women to write that way, and that they wouldn't notice it if it was a male writer. But I am often asked about my interest in the physical, the body, the visceral, and one of the answers is that if you are a woman writing, you wonder, well, what are the differences between women and men? I mean, they must exist. They're anatomical. And you think, are there any other differences? You know, is there something very specifically about female anatomy that makes you better at washing dishes, for example? And you say, well, no. So you say, this is socially constructed and this is real. So I pay very close attention to what is physically real, as opposed to what is socially constructed about how we live in our bodies. We've nowhere else to live, you know. And Yeats's line that we are chained to a dying animal has a lot of resonance for me. But also, and in a specifically female way, I'm very interested in the way that the body gives life as well as the way that it inevitably dies. And that very visceral experience of having children has informed my work very strongly.
And I suppose that is one of the reasons why women are more in touch with their bodies than men, because we always seem to have to deal with that kind of side of things, knowing that at some point in our lives we would probably have some sort of reproductive.
Yeah. Well, the female body
experience is
a problem in the way that the male body is a problem. All bodies are problematic, you know, they don't do exactly what we want them to do. They don't run up the stairs as quick as we would like. But the female body is problematic in two strong senses. One, that is constantly objectified and constantly viewed rather than inhabited. So I'm very interested in inhabiting the body and resisting that thing of the body as being viewed. And also, the female body, to me, has great glories in that it is, you know, in the way that it can produce babies, for example.
Also, the being in touch with your bodies is more a sort of Celtic thing than an Anglo-Saxon one as well. I think the Anglo-Saxons are slightly less able to be in touch with their bodies than Celtic spirit is more earthy. Perhaps that's a generalisation.
It's an interesting generalisation, you know, because I could agree and give you another generalisation and say that Puritanism has resulted in an awful lot of disgust, particularly in male writing. This is, and I'm very suspicious of disgust. But there's an awful lot of it in male writing. There is an awful lot of it. And I just don't do disgust because, you know, disgust is a kind of moral thing. So you don't blame people for the fact that, you know, they sneeze or something. There's no point in being disgusted about these things. Mm-hmm. So I don't have that. And certainly you might say that that's a Puritan kind of idea.
In fact, with your personalities, the characters that inhabit your books, you're very direct about them and you are very unforgiving. But at the same time, it isn't criticism.
Well, I don't know that it's unforgiving. I mean, what am I supposed to forgive or not to forgive? I mean, I try to see. I suppose I try to be precise or I try to be acute. I don't know what there is to forgive, actually. I'm not a moralizer, either personally or as a writer. So I'm not interested in giving out about characters and telling them they're doing it all wrong.
As we said before, you're Irish, and recently I read a comment that said Irish writers seem excited and challenged today. Not just to write in the shadows of Joyce and Yeats, but to expand on that tradition and to develop a vibrant Irish identity. And that was, I think it was John Rickard, who's the editor of a series of publications on contemporary Irish writers. Is there indeed a particular Irish identity? And is this contemporary identity very different from the one that of former generations?
I don't know if writers are concerned with making identity so much as breaking old ideas of identity and reforming them and keeping things alive and moving, you know. Ireland was formed as a peasant country on the fringes of Europe. The first, you know, 40 years of Irish national life after Ireland became separate from the British Empire were about the noble tradition of the noble Celtic tradition, very interested in rural life, very interested in the lovely Irish girl, for example, is an old cliche that, you know, the women are virtuous and the men are heroic, even in their poverty. And so, I mean, that just starts to wear out quite quickly. And there are small fascisms involved in that maybe the Irish girl doesn't want to be lovely anymore. She prefers to have a job or, you know. So I think Irish women always had the vote, but so these things do shift and change, and it is the job partly of the writer to unsettle the cliche and to deconstruct a little. This wave of Irish writing that I'm a part of started in the 1980s, and it started perhaps after the free secondary school education came into the country. But it also came perhaps at a moment of increasing national confidence. So there was a kind of boom in Irish writing long before there was an Irish economic boom, perhaps 5 or 10 years before. And it just seemed that Ireland wasn't interested in... It was just more confident. And the voices started to be raised somehow.
In a way, a bit similar to our experience here in Malta, there was a period after the creation of the Republic of Ireland where perhaps there might have been a desire to imprint the society with this new reality, which was the Republic. And then perhaps there wasn't any need to do that anymore because independence had become the norm. And that allowed writers to move on and explore other places.
I mean, if you look at the history of nationalism in a European context, you see how everybody sort of gave it up to it, you know, moved on, you know, joined the EU, did other things, you know, saw other places and just became more open for one reason or another. Mm. I mean, nationalism isn't ever to be underestimated. We're always amazed by countries fragmenting into different, you know, the fragmentation of the Balkan states and whatever was a great surprise, except if you knew what nationalism, if you remembered nationalism in its glory days, you could see exactly what was going on.
Because here in Malta we had sort of the build-up, in the literary sense, the build-up to independence in 1964, and then the idea of, gosh, you know, now we are an independent sovereign state. And then some years later, the people who were perhaps worried about the idea of independence in the sense of their sense of identity wasn't that so strong. Now that their children knew nothing else, so they weren't bothered about. You know, they were Maltese.
Yes, I mean, I'm very happy not to be a great nationalist, because I figure that I'm absolutely genuinely and authentically Irish without having to sort of wave a green flag all the time.
The motif of family is writ quite large on your writing, in particular, of course, your most well-known book, The Gathering. It's something I feel sure will resonate with Maltese readers, because The Gathering is the story of this hardship that is not so physical, but certainly psychologically tough. It's a tough situation to cope with, this large family with its diverse members, and slightly dysfunctional. But do you think that dysfunctionality is simply part of what belonging to a family means? Is it a necessary part of being within the family group?
Yes, I mean, when people describe the Hegartys, who are the family in The Gathering, as dysfunctional, I did find myself asking, how is a family supposed to function? I mean, they're fine, you know, they meet, most of them, and they chat, and they get on with their lives, and their lives go well or badly, according to various different forces, you know. So I don't know what a perfect family should be or is, and I don't. But the book is about bereavement, you know, because one of the members of the family, Liam, commits suicide, and so the narrator, Veronica, it just fragments basically, and questions. She questions what it is to be alive, almost, because anyway, all the hurts of her past become apparent. She spent a lot of time building a very nice life and a perfect life, and she has a fully functional family with a very nice house, and they all do ballet lessons and piano lessons, and it's all lovely. And yet, you know, the past won't die, it won't go away. So during the book, she sort of falls apart, and then she moves on, and, you know, that's a very small narrative line. it goes back into, she tries to look for the first cause, you know, as people, if there is a suicide, people look for cause and effect. And this is a great problem for a novelist, because you put things in a book one after the other, and it makes it seem like that caused that, but that's not the way our lives go. And something with something like a suicide, the effect is too big for whatever causes there could have been. It's too absolute. So it throws everything into a sharp relief of whether things could have been altered, what it is to be destined in one particular way, why the path of one life goes one way and another life goes another way. So these are the questions that bother her. And she finds an accommodation. There isn't much, as it were, consolation in my work. There's very little sentimental, sort of, nothing comes down from heaven or... Anyway, but she does find a place to stand. She finds a way to live. She finds a way to re-enter her life and to own it. I think that's a good thing to be able to do, to possess her life and not feel that she's somehow a stranger in her own life, which is how she was feeling before.
When I was thinking about how I was going to put that question to you, in fact, before, I thought about this idea of dysfunctionality and families, and I'm inclined to agree with you that dysfunctional isn't really the right word, though I saw it referred to, as the book referred, the Hegartys referred to as dysfunctional, but in actual fact, reading it, I thought, oh, well, I said, this sounds quite familiar, not because I have a family that resembles them, but because that is just family life. It's the ups, the downs, the days that you get on terribly well with people and the days that you don't.
Families spend an awful lot of time trying not to love each other too much, because it's a very dangerous thing for families to do. So that you spend an awful lot of time avoiding your siblings, getting cross with your siblings, getting annoyed with all the arrangements for Christmas Day, feeling that, you know, this sibling has always said the wrong thing to you and that sibling is too wussy or something. So we spend a lot of time getting irritated by our family to somehow avoid this terrible fact that we love them so much. And we have no choice in the matter. We have absolutely no choice in the matter. So I'm very interested in the difference between love that you choose, romantic love, sexual love, and love that you don't choose, the love of your siblings. Some families don't bother with it anymore. They just don't. They just say, I don't get on with my family, which is, to me, amazing, because in Ireland, that's not a possible thing to say. You just get on with your family, whether you like them or not. And then also the love of children, which is not chosen either. It's so absolute and overwhelming. But it's not something you chose. This human being is not somebody you chose. And there they are, and you love them completely. So that to me is both terrible and wonderful at the same time.
Fascinated by that. And as I said before, I'm sure that will resonate with Maltese people because of the fact that we're still at the stage of being with our families quite a bit.
Yes, well, I mean, there's nowhere, you can't be born anywhere else but in a family. I suppose there are abandoned children or lost children, but mostly we are born in a family and there's no other place to be. It's like being born on Mars or on Earth, you know. Earth is where families are. And, you know, there are about three places, Manhattan, London or whatever, where people have no families or don't talk about their family. But at home we say my mother this, my mother that, my mother the other.
Right.
And it's just part of our way of talking and being.
You are both a novelist and a short story writer, and some writers like yourself do manage to straddle the two genres successfully. This summer I had the pleasure of talking to Patricia Duncan, another writer who does work with the two genres very well, in fact, very successfully. Do you approach your short story writing in a different way to your writing your novel? Is it true? Do you think that short story writing is more difficult than writing a novel?
Actually, I find it easier to write short stories than novels. And this is, I find the short story form is very instinctual and a very pleasurable form. And the short stories that are waiting to be written on my computer are like a pleasure deferred. I don't have to work on them. Sometimes they sit there for a couple of years until the moment is right to pick them up and move them along and then finish them. But the novels are always with me. They're always problematic. I think about them walking down the street. I think about them at all times. they need resolution. And so I like to say that a novel is like a marriage, that the commitment, you have to work through it. There's no other way except through. And that short stories are like friends, you know. you meet, and not even friends you have to talk to all the time. So
I love short story writing. I think it's my favorite genre.
I love short stories.
Superb. Just a quote from a review I came across. Anna Wright cares about being right with words. To tell the story is not enough. It has to be well told. Not that you'll necessarily find her work eager to please. Nothing so easy or fawning. It's more the end result of what I'd guess is an almost involuntary drive to do justice to both the work and the reader. Sorry about the long quote, but I found it very interesting because that idea of the involuntary drive, it reminds me very much of my own convent education, and we were always taught to do justice to our work, that we owed that to everyone, and that our hands should always be at the distaff. And I found myself trying to follow that maxim myself because it was drummed into me so much. It's a very tiring thing. Do you find writing tiring?
Well, over 20 years or so, you can get perhaps a bit weary. I agree with all of this. Kurt Vonnegut, the writer, wrote in some introduction how he said to his daughter that even though she was talented, she had no obligation to use those talents. And that made me cry. That just made me cry. That he released her from that. You know, that she was wonderfully talented and that was fine. There was no, she didn't have to produce or make anything. I was at my own convent school reunion on Friday, just a couple of days ago. I was looking around at all these women that I'd gone to school with, and they'd all done different things with their lives. But the thing we were taught by the nuns was not what you made of your life was important, but what you made of yourself. And these women had all made something proper of them, themselves, you know, that they hadn't lost some particular key nugget, you know, they hadn't some essence still there that they had managed not to spoil or mar. I thought it was really wonderful. And their lives had gone in all kinds of different ways. But there was this kind of... So I suppose, yes, and I'm interested in how writers live their lives, because I feel if you don't live your life properly, it starts to show badly in your work, and that the emptiness in some writers' lives, then they start writing beautifully empty sentences. So yes, it is a kind of large, there's a larger overarching moral thing, although I'm not a moralist, as I insist on saying I'm not a moralist, but I do think, yeah, getting it right, yes, yes.
It's important.
It's incredibly fantastic if you hit it, you know. So, and it's and you're bereft if you lose it. So if you're working at the desk and it ain't there, then you're just very sad. And it's nice when you hit it. It's just very nice.
A quick last question as the seconds run on. A question I ask all of my guests: when you've put aside your laptop, your research, your own writing, what books do you curl up on the sofa with your purring pussycat on your knee, just for a relaxed read?
Well, the way my life is, because I have small children, I curl up on the sofa with a purring child or two on my knee, and I read whatever they tell me to read, which at the minute is Harry Potter, which is...
which is long. Bad.
It's long.
Yeah,
it's long.
Stopper.
I'm reading a lot of short stories at the moment, and particularly in the Irish short story tradition, which I love so much. And I try to read things that aren't anything to do with work. And it's very hard for me to find something that isn't to do with work. I get, you know, sent books and I'm supposed to have some opinion about them. So, you know, I come across things that have nothing to do with anything. The next thing I'm going to do is open up a restaurant, and then I won't be able to eat anymore.
That sounds wonderful. Thank you very, very much, Anne Enright, for coming to Campus FM today.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.